And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Paul Shapiro. His book is Clean Meat. Now this year marks the 60th anniversary of NASA. Joining us is someone who has charted the entirety of the 60 years, space historian John Logsdon. Among all of the technological accomplishments of the last century, none has captured our imagination more deeply than the movement of humans into outer space. You may not know that just over 560 humans have traveled to orbit and beyond, and John Logsdon joins us now to tell us the history of NASA's achievements in space, from the Apollo mission to the recent Mars explorations and the Parker Solar Probe. John Logsdon is the editor of the Penguin Book of Outer Space Exploration. John, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Glad to be with you.
Yeah. I was fascinated reading Wernher von Braun's essays that appeared in Collier's in April of 1954, an essay that you put in your book, Can We Get to Mars? And this was just 9 years removed from World War II. It was before Sputnik was put up. It was pre-Alan Shepard's quick up and down in space with no orbit. I mean, von Braun had a besides being one heck of an engineer, he was a pretty good visionary too, wasn't he?
Indeed he was. I mean, whatever one thinks about Dr. von Braun's record, both in Germany and the United States, he certainly had a vision of humanity's future in space that reads well even today. What is it now, 64 years later, the obstacles are still there, the excitement is still there. So, yes, he was a remarkable individual.
So the entire book is put together, not with anecdotal stories, but with actual internal documents from NASA and from, for an example, these essays that appeared in Collier's back in the early 50s. Tell us about why you chose that approach, which is sort of different for a book.
Well, it wasn't my idea to start out with. we at the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University, which I directed for 20 years, got a contract from NASA in the late 1980s to do a so-called documentary history, put together the documents that trace the evolution of the civilian space program. That ended up being 7 volumes, each 600 pages or more, full of documents. And an editor, a young editor from Penguin, Sam Rame, emailed me and said, would you be interested in doing a best of one volume? And I said, of course, and the result is this book.
Wow. So, you start, about the mid-50s. With these internal documents. And I flipped to one that was about in 1958. It's the President's Science Advisory Committee. Introduction to Outer Space is what it's called, which is
right.
Kind of a cute title as you think about it now. And you talk about the 4 factors that give importance and urgency to the advancement of space technology. Can you talk about those?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting to say that this was a report requested by President Eisenhower before there was a NASA. So it was one of the charter documents of why have a space agency and have a space program.
Yeah.
and it was mainly science advisors. And so, of course, they said doing science was important, but technology was important, national security was important, and national prestige. I mean, the fact that space was part of the American image and part of something that a great society does was evident even then. This was after Sputnik, but before NASA.
Right. And your personal involvement started around this time, I believe. Can you talk about how you got involved and sort of that, that witnessing of the first space flight from Cape Canaveral?
Well, not the first flight to the moon.
To the moon, yes.
Yeah. I'm old enough to have remembered Sputnik, but I don't particularly, or Kennedy's announcement of setting the moon as a national goal.
Right.
What I remember first is seeing John Glenn after his flight in February of 1962. I was working in Manhattan and went out and watched John and Vice President Johnson parade by me. And it's kind of lit a spark. It said, hey, this space stuff is interesting. I was going back to graduate school in political science that fall and ended up writing all my papers and my dissertation on space topics. And the career has just followed from there.
I must be pretty old because I remember Sputnik. My father took me out in the front yard and there was a news report that said approximately what time we could see this satellite fly by. And we saw it, and it was a concern because the Cold War had begun, and if you owned space, you kind of owned the world. I mean, that was sort of
the paranoia at the time.
That was the rhetoric, which brings me to this question. Eisenhower, a great president, also a really good general, you know, to start that big decision for D-Day and everything that he did for World War II. There was a lot of pressure, I would imagine, back in the early 50s to give this to the military, and yet they didn't do that. And what was Eisenhower's role? What was the pressure to give it to the military, and what were the forces that were able to convince the right folks to give this to a non-military organization such as NASA?
Well, Sputnik made evident to the national leadership, to the White House, that the United States needed to not only have some space activities, but have a space program and an agency to manage it. Eisenhower's first inclination was to give it to the Department of Defense because he didn't want to proliferate government bureaucracies. He was convinced by his advisors, by his new science advisor, the president of MIT, Jim Killian, and by his vice president, Richard M. Nixon, that it would be better to have a civilian agency able to cooperate with other countries, not having to deal with much classification, an open agency compared to the Soviet secrecy. And he bought the argument and said, okay, I will recommend to the Congress creating a new civilian agency. And the legislation creating NASA was signed in July of 1958, and NASA opened its doors for business on October 1st of 1958. So it turns out, I think, to have been a very wise decision.
And there were folks back then that couldn't really understand why we were going to space. Everybody got really excited about the moon landings and the moon landing in 1969. And then people started to maybe get a little tired of it. And I've had a number of people come up to me and say, well, what has space travel done for us? And I can certainly talk about the missions, and I can talk about the importance of being an explorer and the importance of trying to understand our world and be able to comment on it. And that's what science is. But aside from space travel, how has NASA shaped the history of America? In other words, besides Tang, our breakfast drink, what are some of the technological advancements that we can attribute to this agency?
Yeah, well, first of all, Tang and Velcro are kind of myths.
Oh, I know. I know. I'm just having fun with you. Yeah.
Hey, I know. But and it's very hard to separate out what NASA did from what the military space activities of the military have done in advancing technology. The combination, and particularly the warlike mobilization of money and human resources during Apollo, pushed a whole set of technological frontiers: miniaturization, computing, artificial intelligence, material science, in ways that they would not have progressed as quickly. So I think some of the foundational elements of our modern society are based on space-derived technologies.
Yeah, and yet now NASA's budget is minuscule in comparison, you know, by percentage of the federal government spending compared to what it was back in the 60s. Talk about why that is.
Well, first of all, it's a dangerous comparison because Apollo was special. Apollo was unique. It was not the normal way of things. And so saying, well, we don't spend as much money now as we did during Apollo, we're still spending, NASA's budget is over $19 billion a year. That's still a fair amount of money. The military space budget is even larger than that. So we are spending a fair amount of national public resources on space. Probably not enough to match our ambitions. Those ambitions were adjusted downward by Richard Nixon after the first two moon landings. Nixon was not interested in continuing on a program like Apollo that would send us to Mars in the 1980s, and said space has to become a normal part of our life and something that competes with other things for budget resources. And in that competition, NASA settled at a pretty consistent share of the federal budget of 1% or half of 1%. It's been that way for the past 35 or so years.
Wow. Because the Apollo missions were such a pivotal point, not only in our history, in NASA's history, but also in your personal history, and it may be unfair to ask such a space enthusiast as you, but what's your favorite point, your favorite story from the Apollo missions?
Well, being there.
Yeah.
My dissertation at New York University turned into a book called The Decision to Go to the Moon, which was in publication but not published in July of 1969. I was working with a very senior writer who was writing a book on the history of the moon landing, and that got me a press pass to go, invitation to go to the launch. And that morning, early in the morning, July the 16th, 1969, I was at the building at Kennedy Space Center watching these three guys walk by me on their way to the moon.
Wow.
A few hours later, saw the launch at 9:32 a.m. You know, that's unforgettable to have that experience.
Yeah. Well, Apollo was certainly a very important program, but I also enjoy the history going back a little earlier. I mean, you had guys like Scott Crossfield. I mean, people that names that people have never heard of before that were in the test launch programs,
right?
Like the X-15, for an example, and then of course Gemini. You put Alan Shepard. Alan Shepard was the first non-chimpanzee. There were chimpanzees that went before, but he went up and came down very quickly. And then, as you said, John Glenn, the first guy to actually orbit for the United States. But the Mercury program and then the Gemini program to be able to test out leaving the mothership on a tether. I mean, all of those pieces were so important to a successful Apollo program. And, you know, it's just fascinating when you look at it from a whole of all the different pieces that went into making Apollo successful.
Indeed. And one of my favorite documents in the book is the debate internal to NASA of whether to conduct Ed White's spacewalk on Gemini 4. It was added to the mission after Alexei Leonov and the Soviet Union had done a spacewalk. The decision was that we should do it too and added to the mission. And it was debated very carefully, the risks and benefits of doing it.
Well, I didn't know that story until I read your book, and I think the basic pieces behind that were, if it was not successful, it would be like a 3-day mission versus a 5-day, and that would put more pressure on Gemini 5, if Gemini 4, if the walk wasn't successful, and there was a lot of discussion and a lot of memos and everything else behind that. They did end up going with it, and General White ended up doing the spacewalk, didn't he?
He did. Then to be only tragically killed in the Apollo 1 accident.
Yeah, that
similarly,
was...
there's an account of the decision made in the space of a couple of days to send Apollo 8 to the moon. at Christmas time, 1968. It's hard to imagine we could make decisions that way these days.
And the risk assessment of being able to, I mean, there obviously there was risk to go with Apollo 8 at that particular time frame. They decided just to do it. And that's sort of the a little bit of the old flyboy type of DNA that
yep.
that we're just going to go for it, right? And you wouldn't have that today with all the checks and balances, would you?
Well, there were checks and balances then too. This was not decision casually made, but maybe the balance on the scale was a little more towards risk taking.
We are seeing now, I was going to say branching off from NASA, but it's not even branching off. It's private individuals like Elon Musk, like Jeff Bezos, and probably many others that I don't even know about, who are able, due to their vast resources, to explore space from their own sort of imaginations. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that and how it will either empower NASA or sort of decelerate what NASA is able to do.
Well, I think it will, if Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company, or SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's company, are able to realize their ambitions. Remember, they haven't done any of this yet. They've just talked about it. SpaceX is launching communications and other satellites and travel to supply to the space station. But the vision of launching large numbers of people into space is still some years in the future. When it happens, I think that it will happen after partnering with NASA, working together, public, private, and probably international partnerships to restart space exploration, to once again go beyond Earth orbit, where we haven't been for 46 years. So I think it's all to the good.
Yeah. And I have to say, what Jeff Bezos and SpaceX has accomplished with the return to Earth of the Falcon Heavy, I think that was last year. I mean, that was the most mind-blowing thing. And to witness that, I have to say, I wasn't an early adopter to space exploration, but when I witnessed that, I had some goosebumps.
I was down at Kennedy Space Center for
you
the Falcon
were.
9
oh.
launch.
Oh.
You know, and seeing these two boosters fly back, two or three. I think it's just the two strap-ons that came back kind of in unison to land. I mean, it was just remarkable.
Well, you were very brave. I was thinking about the people standing there thinking, man, things could go so wrong.
Yeah, well, during the launch, everybody is kept far enough away. They calculate how far things could fly and keep you further away.
Yeah, the third one, the main rocket, was to come down on a drone ship. And unfortunately, that one, I don't know if it was the seas or if it was the software, but that one didn't make it.
Didn't work, right?
Fell off the side of the drone
ship. Yeah, but
it
was a near miss.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is so much that I've learned about this program, and I just wanted to ask you a quick one. I mean, here's one that I did not know about. The Saturn V brought us, you know, got us into the right orbit so that we could get to the moon. Saturn V, biggest rocket, most powerful rocket ever. And in fact, they were looking at something that was six times the thrust of the Saturn V, but they ended up going with the Saturn V. You comment on that quickly, because we're just running out of time?
Sure. I mean, when Kennedy said we're going to go to the moon, we didn't know how we were going to go to the moon. And the kind of baseline plan at that point was to build a rocket called Nova, N-O-V-A, which was much more powerful than the Saturn V, and just launch a very heavy spacecraft and directly go land on the surface of the moon. People figured out that that rocket was too big and that we'd have to do rendezvous assembling the spacecraft in orbit in some way. And then there was choice, did we do it in the rendezvous in Earth orbit, or did we do it in lunar orbit with a specialized spacecraft only for landing on the moon and getting back up,
uh-huh.
Which